What happens when two Bass Road Warriors spend quality time talking music and life with one of their peers? Find out every Monday at 8 on Notes from an Artist. Bassist, educator, author David C. Gross, and bassist and head honcho of KnowYourBassPlayer.com, Tom Semioli, trade eights with the legends of rock, jazz, funk, blues, folk, country, and more. Notes from an Artist, revealing conversations with the legends who've created the soundtrack of our lives. Every Monday at 8 on CygnusRadio.com. And check out previous episodes on our podcast. Notesfromanartist.buzzsprout.com.
So we have another two-parter for you. Mr. Bob Groom, photographer to the stars, although he didn't know it at the time. Some of the most legendary photos, John Lennon to be a starting point, work with Yoko. He's got Sex Pistols. He's got this. He's got that. Ah, tons of stuff.
Too much. One of rock's foremost photographers. You know, interesting, we spoke with him about his some of his peers like Mick Rock and Richard Avedon. And unlike them, Bob Groom never worked in the studio. He was on location the whole time. And one of the things that keep cropping up in our conversation with him is he had no plan. He had no plan. He just did. He pretty much winged everything. Like you said, took amazing pictures of John and Yoko, the iconic New York City T-shirt picture with John, the Statue of Liberty picture with John. He tells us the stories behind those. His work with Ike and Tina Turner, the New York Dolls, as you mentioned, Kiss, Chuck Berry, The Clash. And one of the cool things I think he said to us is, he took pictures of thousands of bands, but just a handful of them became icons. So it just shows you the expanse of his work.
Well, also, if you recall, he was mentioning the fact that for 30 years, people said, it seems a little blurry, a little soft focus. And he goes, yes. And now it's a style.
Right. Now it's his own style. Interesting guy, just how he came up from Long Island, middle class, and he went to Greenwich Village in the mid-60s and got caught up in the scene there. Rock and roll was still the wild, wild west. He got a pittance for his photographs, right? I mean, there was no, this was all regional stuff. But it also, I like talking about with Bob Groom is the importance of image in rock and roll. We bring up George Martin again, All You Need Is Ears. Audiences listen to music with their eyes, and those eyes were set on some of Bob Groom's photograph. So this is a real rock and roll history lesson right here.
Yeah, it really is. And as always, New York was the key. New York was the hot spot, the place where it all happened. And here's something else, guys. This is the first time we've ever done a preamble to an interview. Well, we have not even picked one of the songs yet. So we're going to be just as excited.
Let's bring on Bob Groom, man. Let him tell his story.
Yeah.
There he is.
Got it, Siri.
All right, Bob Groom. We see the name Bob.
Hello.
And there's Bob Groom.
Hello, Bob Groom.
Hi.
Well, thanks for being on our show. Look, David, look how nice his background is.
Yeah. I have green screen.
I do. I have a green screen for when I'm not here.
Well, you've been in the right place at the right time many times, and the book is absolutely fascinating. It really
Well, thank you. It
takes you back to a time when young people should really know about it. I mean, David and I lived through some of it. David, you lived through it a little more than I did. It was a golden era when rock and roll was not part of the establishment.
Right. That was the point in the beginning, was to be anti-establishment. That was a big word back then. The establishment was fighting a war that people didn't want to be involved in.
Right.
And the idea was to turn on, tune in, and drop out. Basically what I did, I dropped out to live with a rock and roll band. But what I didn't know was I was actually falling in to the rest of my life and my career.
Fascinating that you say throughout the book, you have no plan. You have no plan.
No, I kind of take it day by day, you know, and see what happens. Because plans are just meant to change anyway. You know, Malcolm McLaren explained to somebody one time, somebody was asking me, Malcolm, what was your plan? How did you know, get started? And Malcolm looked at me and we looked at each other like, plan? And Malcolm said, you know, you go to sleep at night and you have plans for the next day and things you think you're going to do. And you wake up in the morning and the phone rings and things change. Nowadays, of course, the phone doesn't ring, but you get an email and things change. And you just kind of, I've always just kind of go with the flow and try to make the best of however the situation changes. You know, you've got to stay in the current and keep moving.
You talk about being in the right place at the right time. You grew up in Long Island, as I did. And your parents were your lawyers and taught you to question everything, which is probably the perfect training for a rock and roll photographer.
Well, taking pictures of my family also, you know, you have to get six dysfunctional people all looking good for a 60th of a second. And that's basically what I did with a lot of rock and roll bands for the rest of my life. So, you know, but questioning everything, it's not just my parents were lawyers. I think it's the tradition of the religion. You wake up in the morning and you ask questions. And so, you know, when I got around to the Clash and they had the slogan, question authority, I'd already been doing that for 20 years.
You know? That was Garageland by the Clash. This is Notes from an Artist, Cygnus Radio. .com.
Gravitating towards Greenwich Village, obviously, which is where people of your mindset went to, give us an idea of the aesthetic back then. I mean, you were at Newport in 65. There must have been an incredible energy that, you know, permeated the whole culture back then.
Well, it was very much. You know, there was an establishment that was, you know, fighting a war and wanting people to still be kind of the straight, square culture that came out of the Second World War, people conforming, you know, the building towns like Levittown, where every single house is the same. People were meant to dress the same and comb their hair the same. And then in the 60s, the hippie movement started, and folk music actually before that, started rebelling against that, you know, wanting to grow their hair whatever length they wanted or wear whatever clothes they wanted and have whatever job they wanted. But certainly you didn't want a job that would support the establishment that was fighting the war. So there was a whole idea of us and them, and there were alternative newspapers, and that was kind of a big thing, but not in a sense like, I don't know, today it just seems even more polarized than ever, because the us doesn't seem to be a group. You know, back then, if you saw another guy in bell bottoms and his hair was a little long, you kind of gave the high sign. You knew you had something in common. Nowadays, you don't really know what you got in common with anybody.
That's so true. You know, you mentioned World War II, and if you think about it, the period right after World War II, if you were a Jack Kerouac or an Allen Ginsberg, you were even more alienated than ever. And then all of a sudden, you got the Beat Movement going on. Then right. You've got, what did they call them back in the 50s? Dungarees. You can't wear dungarees to school. I remember there were a couple of clothing films that they used to play at schools. And you saw, this is the correct way to dress, and this is not.
Many teenagers are as concerned as their parents with the public's conception of today's youth. This group is our ideal of the proper school attire and social behaviors of the Hicksville Junior High.
You weren't allowed in. You had to have a shirt with a collar. T-shirt was underwear. And you didn't show a T-shirt in public. Like maybe if you were out, you know, on a weekend mowing the lawn, you could wear a T-shirt. But people generally didn't go out of the house wearing a T-shirt. A T-shirt was not clothes. It was underclothes. And I remember you had to have a shirt with a collar and your hair could not touch your collar. Your hair had to be shorter than the collar. And of course, that all changed. I mean, you know, I have younger friends, people in their 40s and 50s who went to school in blue jeans, you know, dungarees, as you say. Yeah, they weren't even called blue jeans. That was not allowed. You couldn't go to school in dungarees and a T-shirt. That was absolutely, you could sit home with a note for that.
You know? Right. I think the real change happened when John Kennedy was elected, because he had that swooping thing down the front.
His hair wasn't that neat. Yeah. It was kind of, he was much freer and much looser. And that was a big deal.
Yeah. And then you had the.
In fact, he did his inauguration. He didn't have a top coat. I remember he just had a suit. And everybody was kind of shocked how casual he was. Things changed a lot. If you see the films, actually, it's very clear. There's a film of the Newport Folk Festival.
Yeah.
And
yes.
There's a film of the Woodstock Folk Festival. If you see people in the Newport Folk Festival walking into the festival, they all have shirts with collars. And many of the men have a sports jacket, like Kerouac and Ginsberg had a tweedy-looking academic type, but still a sports jacket. A man wore a jacket and a shirt, maybe not a tie. That's how casual we were. We didn't wear ties.
That was a seminal moment in rock history. Bob Dylan went electric at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival. The tune was Maggie's Farm. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
You see the films of people walking into Woodstock, everybody's just wearing a T-shirt.
If they're wearing anybody, anything.
I remember I have a picture of myself. I had a shirt with a collar.
That was Joe Cocker, live at Woodstock, doing Let's Go Get Stoned. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Once the Beatles came, everything was over.
Everything changed with the Beatles. People started growing their hair longer than, you know, where people heard that the Beatles, you know, were doing the psychedelic music. Everybody started smoking pot. People started taking acid.
You just heard two tracks by the Beatles. The first one, I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is from the February 9th performance live on Ed Sullivan. And now we just listened to Strawberry Fields Forever. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
The Beatles were a great inspiration for a lot of people. They weren't necessarily the first. I mean, somebody gave them the acid. Somebody else had already done it. You know, somebody right. else, Astrid Kirshner, had gone to Paris and seen other people, young models, put their hair longer and came back and said, you should have your hair longer. But when they did it, they got the media and the whole world saw it. And people thought, oh, that's cool. But movements start, for whatever reason, in several different places. And then it comes together. Because I remember, for some reason, around 1960, or whatever year it was, I felt like growing a mustache. And at first, it was kind of funny. You know, first week or two, you just look like you haven't shaved. And my friends were saying, what are you doing? You know, I said, I'm growing a mustache. Why are you doing that? 3 months after I decided to do it, when I was actually growing in and it looked like a mustache, all of a sudden, a Beatle album came out, Sgt. Pepper's, and all the Beatles had a mustache. Well, within 2 weeks, all my friends were growing mustaches.
Well, I'll tell you, Tom can attest, over COVID, I was trying to grow up. And I'm still an adolescent. I can't. It still looks like 6 months later than I'm growing. I need a shave.
When we did the lockdown, the first month, I thought, well, I'm not going anywhere. I don't have to shave. And so, yeah, I got a COVID beard. After about a month, it was starting to actually feel like a beard. And my wife was starting to say, are you really going to keep that? Aren't you going to shave someday? and then actually, I was in a meeting with people who were upstate. And it's a meeting I see on, well, we're doing it on Zoom for the first time. But, and it's all people I knew. And some guys have beards, some guys don't have beards. And I was looking at them. And all of a sudden, I saw myself in the middle of the picture. Of everybody, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm not a beard guy. Well, why do I look like a beard guy? So that was the end of that. Between that and my wife talking about it, it was like, all right, I'm supposed to shave. I'm, you know, 76 years old. I'm not a kid. They can do
that. Are you surprised if Gillette lost a lot of money over the COVID time?
Well, not just that. People started having this grubby look as if that's supposed to be a good look. I don't know. To me, I'm older. It looks like it looks grubby. It looks like you didn't either shave or not. But people who are like, they keep a consistent 5-day growth. I don't know.
Mark Weiss was shooting a band I was in, and I had a mustache. Uh-huh. And when the pictures came out, started looking at it, I looked like Dirk Diggler.
Oh, my God.
I was over Ian McDonald's house because I had joined his band after he left Foreigner. And I went right into his bathroom and shaved the damn thing. Facial hair is not for me.
You know, I was at Studio 54 at a party, and everybody seemed to have a mustache. It was just kind of, why am I doing this? It's not any different. And I went up to a friend of mine and I said, do you think I should shave my mustache? And she looked straight at me and said, do you like anybody with hair on their face? And I said, well, actually, no. And then I was on my way home that night, and I was wearing a pair of vinyl pants, and I had the mustache, and everything. I stopped to buy a newspaper like 4 a.m. There was some drunk sitting by the newsstand, and he looked at me and goes, what's those? Are those pants real? And I said, yeah, they're real. And he touched them, and he said, oh, they're plastic. And I said, yeah, they're real plastic. And I had a button on from David Johansen's band. It said, Funky But Chic. Right. And the guy goes, Funky But Chic, what's that? And I said, that's what these pants are, pal. And then he goes, oh, you're one of them hippie guys. And that was it. I went home that night. I shaved a mustache. I was like, no, I'm not hippie anymore.
But it's interesting how things changed fashion-wise from 60s to 70s. So 60s, we've got, the different drummer, Conspiracy, all these great clothing. I worked at a place called Pandemonium on the West Side.
Ah, good one.
Yeah, and, you know, you went from bell-bottoms to these skin-tight things and then the vinyl and more leather and stuff of that ilk. It was fashion was different. Fashion today is, I guess, in a lot of respects, a copying, a mirroring of some of the stuff from the earlier days.
I mean, you know, my wife's a fashion designer and she started with J. Crew for a year. And she said, there's only so many ways you can design a T-shirt. Like, everybody's got a neck and two arms, and that's the T-shirt. You know, there's like only subtle changes you can do. You can have a different thread, a different fabric, but you can't change two arms and a neck, you know? Yeah. And so it's fascinating to me. Actually, I've seen something that appeals to me. I've seen it in a museum in France and here in America, too. And actually, I saw it on Crete. There was a fresco. And if you look at the clothes that people are wearing, it's basically the same. I mean, the guy has a tunic, a skirt, a shirt that basically, once again, two arms and a neck. You know? And as far as the shoes, the sandals haven't changed. I had a moment where I was in a museum with my granddaughter. She was about seven, and we were in a Metropolitan Museum of Art, and they have this 15-foot-high sculpture of a naked soldier who's got a sword in one hand and a bloody head in the other. And I hadn't meant to show that to my seven-year-old granddaughter. We accidentally went through that section, and we came through the door, and all of a sudden there's a giant statue. And I didn't really want her looking up at the crush. And so what I noticed was, I said, oh, my God, look at the guy's feet. Now, this is a 3,000-year-old sculpture. The sandals on the sculpture were exactly the same as my granddaughter. Like, the design, you know, I mean, you got a foot, you got some straps, it's the same thing. But the fact that the embroidery was like a vine, like a grapevine kind of embroidery on the leather, was the exact same as what she was wearing 3,000 years later. So, you know, things don't change like that. And people keep recycling. They change the color. They change the fabric. I mean, it went from cotton to vinyl. But nowadays, you go out to Brooklyn, you'll see every fashion that's ever been invented.
That was David Bowie doing fashion. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
I mean, some of the kids are walking around looking like my grandmother. Other kids walk around looking like the comic books that I read as a kid. I mean, it's all unisex fashion where people have like one, you know, a spandex jumpsuit. And you don't know if it's a boy or a girl, and it doesn't matter because it's not up to you. Who cares, you know, what they wear? But fashion's always been something that's been kind of very much on my mind. I've always been very aware of what I'm looking at, who I'm photographing. I never really went into the fashion business because most of those kind of photo sessions are committee events where you have an art director and a stylist and three other people from the client. And I prefer to work on my own, just me and the artist that I'm taking the picture of. That way we have some communication. I'm looking to get that kind of communication in my picture. I'm not looking to sell a shirt. It's a different kind of business, you know, but I am very aware of fashion and how it affects people. And I must say that when I was going to a job, I would dress very differently if I was going out to photograph Kiss wearing probably leather pants, or going to photograph the Bay City Rollers, where I'd always make sure to have some kind of tartan in my outfit. You know, I always like to make the act that I'm working with comfortable. Like, I'm not kind of weirdo. I have a similar kind of outfit to whatever they have, but not to outdress them, because sometimes it's a little easy to better even than the singer, because their style level is kind of low.
That was Saturday Night by the Bay City Rollers. This is Notes from an Artist on Cygnus Radio.
I learned that lesson auditioning for Billy Idol. I'll tell you, Tom, you know this story, right?
Yes, and I actually got a fashion faux pas auditioning for Madonna, but you go with Billy Idol first. We're both bass players, so, by the way, Bob.
So before the audition, I went to Parachute and bought all this geometric GQ kind of clothes, walked into the audition. Everyone was in leather. I realized that I don't care if I play bass with my balls. I'm not getting this gig.
That was Billy Idol doing Dancing with Myself, which is exactly what I had to do after I left that audition.
Is that the tour that Kenny Aronson
did? No, Phil Fight got that one.
Because I remember,
a little earlier.
A real lesson in rock and roll that Billy did a really successful tour. I actually did a picture on that tour. Vital Idol was the album cover I did for him that came out after that tour. But Kenny, we were all really happy. They played Madison Square Garden, and Kenny had been a friend of me and a couple other guys. I knew Kenny since Dust.
Talk about a fashionable bass player. I mean, come on.
Anyway, Kenny's a great guy. And so we were backstage congratulating him, like, oh my God, you played Madison Square Garden. How fantastic. And he goes, I'm out of work. And we said, what? He said, tonight's the last night of the tour. Tomorrow, I'm out of work.
I'm a victim of circumstance.
And that's the life of a musician. You know, you can be on tour and everything's great for 3 months. And then the day after, you're back home with cats, you know.
Well, you mentioned in your book, Bob.
Wait a second. No. Let's do this Madonna thing. You're not.
Oh, you want to hear that? Okay, my story isn't exciting. This was before she was famous. I was called. A friend of mine says, "Hey, this production company is looking for a bass player, and the pay is pretty good. You get on retainer." So I thought that's great. And he said, "The only thing is, you have to be 6 feet tall." And I'm about 5'10", but this was 1981. And I still had my platform shoes from the 70s. So I put on platform shoes.
I do the audition, David. It's one of those auditions where you have to read charts. I read the chart down. I didn't care for the music. Nowadays, it's called grunge, but then it was just called bad music, I guess. I read the chart. Yeah. I got the gig. They said, okay, show up at the office. Well, you know, you sign your papers and your contract and everything. I made the mistake of going to the office with my Converse sneakers on. So I was back to being 5'10" again. And that was it. I was fired before I even got hired.
Aww.
And I had a bouffant like Bob did. I had an Afro Jufro, whatever.
We call it an Isro.
Isro. That's right. I had an Isro.
That was Vogue by Madonna. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
We're going to talk about the importance of image in rock and roll, even when it was anti-establishment. And there's a book that George Martin wrote in 1979 called All You Need Is Ears. And he says in the book, as talented as the Beatles were, and you know, and even though you know he did mold them to be a pop band, he says the Beatles were just incredible to look at. He said it was so important, their image, just the way they carried themselves. And Bob, even though rock was anti-show business, image was so very, very important, and that's what you captured that helped these stars.
I don't know if it was anti-show business. It was kind of anti the past.
Okay.
But everybody knew they were in show business. And for myself, I think that, you know, if this is called show business, there should be a show to see.
Yeah.
And so I've always liked bands that took the time to look different, to look special. So there was something to see, you know, like the New York Dolls, for instance, or Kiss, or, you know, Alice. I mean, they have a stage persona. You go to see a show, you see a show. When grunge came out, I remember, like, the first time I took a picture of a grunge band, they came out to, I was in an alleyway outside of an awards thing, and the guys came sauntering out. I thought it was the Roadies. I was waiting for the band to show up, you know. And actually, I did a panel one time in Austin at the South by Southwest, and the idea was rock and roll. And I had John Varvatos and B.P. Fallon and Jesse Malin and a number of people discussing whether or not you could teach rock and roll. Like, could they buy John, you know, could John Varvatos take somebody walk into a store and he said, okay, put this on and you'll look like a rock star. We all decided that you could buy whatever clothes you wanted, but that there was a charisma that you can't buy. You either have an attitude and you know how to look cool, in which case you could wear just about anything, or you don't. And if you don't, it doesn't matter how sparkly the shirt is. If you don't wear it right, you don't look right. And so there is a whole charisma thing that goes on to get rock and roll. I mean, you still need a haircut and attitude is the basis of rock and roll image. But actually, the attitude is 90% of it.
Right.
Well, you know, Bill O'Coin said something to me when he was managing one of my bands, and he said, Steve Stevens, I told him, even if he goes to the deli, he has to dress like he's on stage. You must dress like that always. And it was an interesting thing because he managed me 3 years after I failed when he was managing Billy Idol. So I had already learned that lesson by then. But another thing, Tom, I don't know who said this, but someone we were interviewing said, I can tell when he straps the bass on if he's going to be good or not.
Yeah.
Who was that?
I don't, you know, a lot of people have said that. I think Ron Carter said that to us. Spoke with Ron Carter. I think probably Carmen Rojas. I think that's true of a lot of musicians, and you probably know it as a photographer. When you see a photographer hold up their camera, you know if they know what they're doing or not. Or just by the way they carry themselves, I would.
I actually got a job kind of because of that. The first time somebody ever said that, I was working as an assistant in a photo studio, and I left there and I went to a different studio. And that studio, we actually took the pictures in the museums for the. They used to sell slides, the transparencies at the gift counter. Nowadays, you can probably buy a program or something. Or I don't know what, a thumb drive? You can't even plug a thumb drive in anymore. But anyway, I used to make these little transparencies. And what it was, we had to take absolutely perfect pictures of paintings. And we set up some polarized lights. And setting up the lights sometimes took an hour because you had to have completely even light on the painting. Because if one side was a little dimmer than the other, then in the picture, it would look darker. Whereas the artist hadn't actually painted it darker. So you had to have a perfectly flat, even lighting. And very, very technical. So we would be set. So the first night I was working for this guy, I got the job one morning, and that night we're in the museum working all night from 9 at night till 3 in the morning when it's dark and nobody's in the museum. And I was doing everything, and then you had to actually count, with a stopwatch or something. We had 45 seconds or a minute and a half long, very long exposure, so that we could have a very small lens opening and everything would be super sharp and in focus. So we're counting off the long exposure and setting the lens and doing these things. And about the second night, I think, might have even been towards the end of the first night, my boss kind of looked at me and he said, you look much more like a photographer than I do. I want you to keep taking the pictures. And after the second night, the third morning I was on the job, he quit and I became the manager. And he was just intimidated. He just said, you look so much more like a photographer. He actually wanted to study South American history. Go figure. It was the wrong job for him, but it was the right one for me. But it had to do with, you have a confidence, you have an ability to fit into that role. And I guess it's the same thing with musicians. You'll see a guy play. I mean, some people like Clem Burke or Jim Keltner, a couple of guys I know who are drummers, can play the fastest music. Charlie Watts, he can play theoretically very fast music without breaking a sweat. They look like they're just having a good time back there. Bing, 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 just doing everything in the right place, the right time, but not flailing about, and trying to look like you're fantastic, but just being fantastic, which is a lot more subtle.
And talking about photographers, I mean, we think of photographers as some of the more high profile ones as Mick Rock and I guess Richard Avedon, who were stars in their own right. But in your book, you talk about how you had such a very unassuming persona, and that's how you gained the confidence of your subjects, which was so very important because you took such candid photographs.
Well, Mick and I are very different. Mick works mostly in a studio, whereas I work wherever people happen to be. So in my situation, going into somebody else's environment, you have to be much more subtle and unobtrusive, whereas Mick, I'm strolling into the room, hello, darling, but it's his room, it's his studio. So he commands a presence, whereas I'm a visitor usually, in somebody else's space. So I mean, Mick and I are old friends because we don't compete. We do very different things. We're colleagues. Right.
And then, of course, obviously, you talk about some people who just can't take bad photographs. I would say your work with Ike and Tina Turner, especially Tina,
Yeah. Well, you can't really take a bad picture of Tina. She's just always fantastic. Same thing with people like Debbie Harry, and in a different kind of way, Patti Smith. People who just are themselves and don't really put on airs. They just project themselves.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some people who are kind of trying to have a persona, you can catch an off moment. But other people who are just themselves, they don't have off moments.
When you think about the beginnings of punk were around 75, 76, really. The photographer that comes to mind is Helmut Newton with that Bloomingdale's thing with the Doberman Pinschers. Do you remember that?
Not specifically, but I do admire Helmut Newton. He's pretty out there.
Yeah, so there was a Bloomingdale's, I guess it was a catalog. They were grabbed up within the first 20 minutes, obviously. Okay. And there's this great shot of a Doberman Pinscher. They were doing shoes on a model's foot. And, all hell broke loose. Oh, how could they do this, that? But it was the most amazing picture. And it really, in some ways, the supposed violence of it as we're working into punk music made a really interesting, combination.
Photographers, do that kind of thing where they think of a concept and then create it. My work is kind of the opposite, where I find what's going on and try to capture it. I don't usually create a shot, by telling somebody, why don't you do this and we'll go there and you'll turn like this and look like that. Like when I'm doing a session, I don't give me more leg, baby. I often say almost nothing. And I just wait for people to find their own comfort level, to find the way they feel like looking at the camera. Because I always felt if I tell them what to do, then they're going to be looking like they're doing something that somebody told them to do, rather than just looking like themselves and looking at something that they thought up themselves. It's rare. I mean, that's why one of the reasons I'm really proud of the picture I took of John Lennon, the Statue of Liberty, is because that was a conscious thought in advance where I said, wow, that would be a good picture if we did this. And John happened to agree with me and he said, that's a great idea. Let's go to the Statue of Liberty. So in that case, we went there on purpose.
That was Give Me Some Truth by John Lennon. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
Yes, with the Dress to Kill came as part of a photo novella that we were making for Cream magazine. A photo novella is kind of like a comic book made of photographs. And it was two pages where Kiss finds out about a John Denver concert, which we actually cleverly disguised by calling him John Cleveland. But they hear about this concert and they think that the world is just getting so boring and they want to save the world with rock and roll. So they put up fake posters and everybody comes to the John Cleveland concert and they come out as Kiss and they save the world and they get rewarded. They get medals pinned on them and they have an orgy. For some reason, the picture that's titled Kiss Orgy is one of the most popular pictures on my website as far as, you know, number of hits. But when we did that with a picture that as we were coming out of that, we went to a subway and they're dressed in suits and ties because in the morning when they find out about this concert, they're actually on their way to work in their secret identity. You know, like Clark Kent has a suit and tie instead of looking like Superman. In this case, they did have their Kiss face, as if nobody would recognize their face, you know, being Kiss. But they had suits and ties. And as we came out of the subway, I said, oh, here, let's take some pictures on the sidewalk, stand over by that lamppost. And then we took some pictures and we moved on. When Kiss saw the magazine with the picture of them by the lamppost, they loved it so much, they said, oh, we're going to use that for an album cover.
That was Rock and Roll All Night by Kiss. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
So it wasn't even done originally for the album cover. They came up, looking at the picture, they came up with the title Dress to Kill. That wasn't preconceived. That was something they decided after they saw the picture.
And I think right after that, they did a comic book where they allegedly said we have our real blood in the...
It's not alleged.
It's hilarious.
No, that wasn't alleged. I was there when they poured their blood into the ink. Yes, they actually had real Kiss blood. It was quite a day. Stan Lee came with us. It was really exciting for me, having been grown up on Marvel Comics, to actually meet Stan Lee on this private plane. We flew up there. In fact, on the plane, being kind of corporate shit, they had like a Playboy magazine and a couple other magazines for the execs to look at. So I'm looking at the Playboy magazine, and that month, that exact day, there was an interview in Playboy magazine with Stan Lee, and there was a picture that he had made that showed him flying across the page as Spider-Man. So I just jumped across the aisle. I said, hey, Stan, would you sign this for me? So I got an autograph on that picture from Stan Lee. You ever see it on eBay, you'll know I'm broke.
Well, I thought it was very flattering that Chuck Berry asked you for your autograph when you took
that
a
was
shot.
The first time I ever signed a photo. I'll never forget the moment. You know, always having been Chuck Berry being like God to me growing up in the 50s, and then actually meeting him, which was even more, you know, just talking to him was amazing. And then when he asked me, he said, I want to buy this picture from you, and he gave me a $100 bill, and then he said, I want you to autograph it. And I had never signed a photo. I didn't, you know, have the concept of a photograph as art yet, really. I remember I didn't want to mess up the front of the picture, so I wrote on the back to the King of Rock and Roll, Chuck Berry. I always wonder where that print is nowadays.
That was C'est La Vie by Chuck Berry, 1964. Let's get back to our interview with Bob Groom. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
Isn't his home a museum now in St. Louis?
It's probably there in his home. Yes. Actually, it's something I was very proud of. Chuck Berry had my picture in his house, and so did Bo Diddley.
Wow.
Right at the door, Bo Diddley had one of my pictures. Actually, the picture in Bo Diddley's house was a picture of him and Chuck Berry.
And that was Bring It to Jerome, Bo Diddley. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
When I look at your pictures of John Lennon, it seems to me that he was very comfortable in front of the camera. And I guess that was born of your relationship because you guys were friends. But John looks very, very casual in your shots.
Well, because we were casual together, yes. I mean, that part came about because we were friends. But working with John Lennon was very easy because when I met him in 1971, it was the first time I ever saw him. He had been a Beatle, you know, since 1960, whatever. And as Beatles, they did photo sessions every day, several times a day. It's an interesting thing. If you look at pictures of the Beatles, they're wearing a different outfit in almost every single picture. There are pictures of the Beatles in every outfit, from bathing suits to duck costumes. I am the walrus, you know, but there's a million different suits, ties, shirts, polka dot shirts, black shirts, you name it. There's a picture of the Beatles. They must have done, because they're only together like, what, 4 or 5 years. A lot of bands have like 10 different pictures that you know about them or something. They do a picture 2 or 3 times a year. They'll do a photo session because bands need promotion and pictures. But the Beatles must have done photo sessions every day. Sometimes a couple of times a day, because you just see unbelievable number of pictures of them in different outfits, different places. It's like they were always having their picture taken.
I am the walrus, the Beatles, Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
So by the time I met John 10 years later, since he had started the Beatles, he was so comfortable having his picture taken. He wanted people to you know, he knew that people were interested, and so he wanted his life documented. So it was no problem to have a photographer around all the time, in the studio or in the kitchen. He just, you know, was very comfortable having his picture for different cameras. They had the SX-70 Polaroid. In fact, I remember being the first one to show him the SX-70. My mom, who was into photography, when the SX-70 first came out, they only sold them in the South, in Florida and a couple other places as a test market because of the temperature. The film couldn't get super cold. So my mom bought me one down there in Florida. And that was the first one that John Yoko saw.
And this was a time before artists took control of their image. You mentioned that in the book and how that kind of changed the whole perception of rock music. I guess at that point it was starting to become a more, you know, showbiz, because your pictures have a connection to the people, where, you know, artist controlled pictures, they're kind of antiseptic, they're kind of planned, they're kind of
It became advertising instead
of... Yes, that's the word. Yeah.
You know, when I was working, people wanted to show who they were and what they were. In the 80s, when the corporations started taking over, they much more planned, like, we want you to look like this, and this is the photograph we want of a certain person. And by the early 80s, 83, 84, people started wearing makeup. I remember by the mid-80s, I had to get a makeup artist for a lot of our photo sessions, and there's still a number of bands like, oh, we don't do makeup. I'm like, this isn't like New York Dolls, because it'll just take the hangover off. It'll make you look like you've been in Jamaica for 3 days. I had a very good makeup artist, so it didn't look like you were wearing makeup. You just looked a little healthier. And, you know.
And how did MTV change the business of the art form that is rock photography?
Well, MTV changed it drastically. That was a big part of people being so much more aware of creating an image rather than just capturing an image. With so many people watching, you know, millions of people watching the image. I mean, before that, you'd hear music and you were much more involved with hearing music, and you could see a picture of a band. Oh, that's what Buffalo Springfield looks like. You know, there's a couple of pictures, but there was no internet that you could go and check it out all the time. It's like when you got a copy of Cream magazine, or if you picked up a copy of Rolling Stone, then you could see what a band looks like.
Right.
But mostly you were interested in the music.
That was For What It's Worth by the Buffalo Springfield. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Yeah, after MTV, the image became so important, because everybody looking at a band first, or hearing the music while they're looking at the band. So you really had to create an image of what you looked like. I actually found it funny that since there is an internet now and you can instantly see anything like that, I realized that when a doctor told me, I had a doctor appointment, he mentioned that he was in a band in college and in New Jersey. And I went home and I realized that I immediately started Googling to see what the band looked like, which was more interesting to me than what they sounded like. You know, if they were wearing purple bell bottoms and a pink tie this big, I would have a better idea of what they were going to sound like before I clicked on the music. What I wanted to see, was he the guy with the purple bell bottoms, or was he the guy who was wearing a suit and tie? You know, what kind of music from their image?
Well, true. My dentist is, or was, the keyboard player for Every Mother's Son. A real clean-cut band.
That was my dentist playing keyboards with Every Mother's Son. Come on down to My Boat, Baby. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I think my first recollection of any video of a band was I'm a Loser by the Beatles on Hullabaloo. And that was just the band playing their song. Until MTV, you didn't, and so many of MTV's videos have nothing to do with the song.
No, they're stories, little stories. One that I remember, I forget what song it was, but there's a girl who goes down into a fallout shelter, and there's a whole scene about getting stuck in a fallout shelter. But the cartoon of Dire Straits, I Want My MTV, that shows the workers in a factory packing up refrigerators and TVs and saying, that ain't working. You know, look at those guys. Yeah, MTV changed everything. You know, video killed the radio star. That was one of the first videos, and it's so totally true. That might even be the one with the fallout shelter. Video killed the radio star.
That was the first video.
Well, the first on MTV, yes.
That was the Buggles doing Video Killed the Radio Star. And that's an interesting band, because it was Jeff Downes on keyboards, who was in Yes, and also Asia, and Trevor Horn, bassist, who produced everyone from Yes to Frankie Goes to Hollywood. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I mean, there were videos before that, but they were hard to see because there was no channel that you could see at home. I remember when the Ritz opened in New York in like 1982. It was a big theater, and the claim to fame at the Ritz was that they had a 25-foot screen, and that in between the bands, they would play rock videos.
Yes,
which was becoming a new thing because there were bars that would play video. It was around 76, 77 that record companies started putting out videos of their bands, but they would put them out to bars. I know a guy, actually, I forget the name of the company, but he had a monthly service where he would send a cassette, a 3/4-inch video cassette of new videos of the month, and he would send them out to bars that played rock video. And the Ritz being the one with the biggest, brightest screen, and you would go there. I mean, there'd be a band every once in a while, but in between the bands were all these videos of people. Some people would go, they didn't care what band it was. They wanted to see all the new videos. Of course, then when MTV came out, that was even in the early 80s, you still went to the Ritz because who had cable,
Right, exactly.
Cable was something you had to pay for. So it took a while for MTV to catch on. I remember thinking it was kind of funny. When MTV first came out in 1981, I believe, we couldn't get it in New York. For the first year, it wasn't available on the New York cable channels. And we were all going, I want my MTV.
Right. But then downtown got it faster than uptown. Because there was a demarcation line. I forget the name of the two competing companies.
Well, Manhattan Cable was on 23rd Street.
Right. Okay.
They were the main cable. But yeah, they had to wire buildings that had people who could pay for cable. Yeah. Kind of funny that as the city was getting more and more wired, I started recording bands with a portable video camera in 1970, when the Sony Portapack was invented.
Right.
I talked my dad into buying me one, and I started videotaping bands. Actually, the first one I talked about in my book, where I started working with Tina Turner, because Tina loved the fact that she could see the show with the orchestra right after they did it. Before that, the only way a band could see themselves is if somebody had the money to pay for a film, which you would then have to get developed and then have a projector and a screen to show it. Whereas with video, you could tape a show, roll a videotape was $10, and that way cheaper than film, and you didn't have to process or anything. You'd tape a show and immediately go into the dressing room or the hotel and play it back on any TV and see the show. So that was a huge thing for bands to be able to see it, and I started taping more bands. The New York Dolls loved watching themselves on TV.
And that was the New York Dolls. That was Trash from a rock concert with Ron Delsner. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
And then I started taping more and more bands. I had a good connection with the owner of Tramps here in New York, and they had everybody from Willie Dixon to Tracy Nelson to Larry Coyle. And I made all these tapes. And when the cable started around 73, 74, part of the deal with the city is that the city insisted that it wasn't just commercial. They had to open two channels for community access.
Right. Was, yes.
And the public access. So you could go there and just sign up. First come, first serve. You get a half hour or an hour. So I started showing the videotapes I was making of bands. And I took 2 half hours and 2 hours a week. And I would just take random times, like 1 in the morning, or whenever I thought rock and roll people might be sitting there stoned watching TV, and then my show would come on. And a couple of years later, because my building, I live in a artist building in the West Village, and it's subsidized building, so there's not here in West Beth, yeah. So it's a building that basically the whole building people don't really have much money here, and they hadn't wired us up at all. Down the block where they got brownstones and rich people, those people could afford it, they got it, but our block we didn't get the cable. And one day I was talking to somebody at the cable company. And I mentioned that was Bob Gruen. He said, "Oh, are you the guy who has those rock and roll videos?" I'm like, "Yeah, I do." He says, "I love your show, man. You're showing all those, videos from different clubs." And because I called to ask when they could get to our neighborhood. He was like, "Oh, we're not going to your neighborhood." Then when he found out who I was, he says, "You mean you can't watch your own show in your own building?" I said, "No, it's not in our building." He said, "I'll take care of that." So I got the whole building because I had my TV show. But around 76 or so, by that time, people started owning cassette. They were 3/4-inch. They were big. VHS came out like 78 or so. But the first cassettes, people started having, and I didn't like the idea of showing my videos and people recording them. I didn't want people to have copies of my videos. So I stopped my TV show, and nobody had ever really talked to me. I didn't know if people were even watching it. It was just something I did as a hobby. But people didn't really seem, too involved. As soon as I stopped, I started getting calls, letters, friends talking to me like, "What happened to your show?" And I was like, "You watched it?" And one friend said, "Yeah, I never had to go out anymore. You were showing me what was going on around town." But it wasn't until I stopped that people said anything to me about it. It was kind of funny. I
love the parts in your book where you talk that your apartment was the place to hang because you showed all these videos
video parties. Yeah,
yeah, your video parties.
We had Elephant's Memory, LaBelle, and a couple of people, Mike and Tina, band all in the living room at the same time. Turner came one time. John and Yoko came one time. Even though it's all available, I had the tape recorder. It was $1,500. But most people didn't have a machine to play a tape. So they all had to come to my house to watch it. It was easier than film, but they couldn't do it at home yet.
That equipment must have been expensive in those days. And it must have been bulky because, right, were the cameras big?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I remember noticing how at one point the box that the camera came in, when they had a camera that had a cassette built in, that was smaller than the camera that I used. The camera I used was about this big with the camera and lens and so on. And then there was a cable that attached it to the actual tape recorder, which was a reel-to-reel tape recorder, like the old-fashioned thing. It was a half-inch tape. You threaded it through the reels and you carried this thing on your shoulder. It was about 40 pounds. And that would work for half an hour on the battery. So to make it last a bit longer, you wore a belt. The belt was about another 12-15 pounds, and that would make it work for another hour. Like the belt, the battery belt lasted about an hour. So you could get about an hour and a half portable to videotape. Now, it was black and white. The sound was mono. The quality, it didn't really work very well at all in low light. It was about the quality of a Polaroid. But at the time, it was a modern invention. It was a modern miracle that you could tape something and go back and immediately show it back, and you could afford it. A half hour was $10 once you made the initial investment, which, yes, $1,500 in 1970 was a lot of money. Somehow I convinced my dad that this was going to be, the videotape was the future, and I had to be in on it. And it was a good thing, but after a while, actually, by 76, as videotape really started taking off, it became a committee project. You needed to have lighting and sound and producers, and I, like I said before, I like to work alone. So between that and the fact that people were going to start copying the tapes, I just stopped making tapes. But it's fascinating to me now to see everybody's got a little stereo color recorder in their hand.
They call them telephones, yeah.
Ugly George, boy, he was funny. He would just walk around town and confront people. He had a whole contraption on his back with
lights. And a spacesuit.
Yeah, he was like a backpack, you know.
And then, of course, the great Al Goldstein. And yeah. And it's interesting because with the networks, I remember with Manhattan Public Access, I think you paid, what, $25 and you got your show on for half?
No, it was free.
It was free, okay. The networks tried to co-opt that, but they couldn't approximate the DIY aesthetic of it. They just...
Not at all. No.
They couldn't do it.
That's where Glenn O'Brien had his TV party where he would tape a sort of a panel on stage at the Mud Club. And he had Jean-Michel Basquiat and Debbie Harry and a lot of the downtown artist people. He packaged some of them, Glenn O'Brien's TV party. You can get on, I guess it's streaming. Everything's streaming. I was going to say a DVD, but I've seen so many advances in my life. It's kind of weird to realize that as I'm older, looking back, I remember when cassette recorders came out. You know, the fact that there was a cassette, you know, eighth-inch tape that, you know, worked, played stereo, man, was a new invention. And the phone, I don't know why they call it a phone. It does so much. I mean, you have your phone in your hand. It tells you anything you ever wanted to know in the world. If remember to just ask Google. You know, people in their 40s, they don't take calls. You can text them and they'll text back. And sometimes, you know, when you're texting somebody and you go two or three times, you're texting and they're answering right away. I think, the guy's got his phone around in his hand. Why don't I just call him and we'll have this whole conversation and have type over and over. And you call and call and call and they don't answer the phone. And you text back and say, oh, I can't talk right now. But you can type, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's a new world to me to see all of this, but it's fascinating. When my granddaughter was 3, she's 11 now, but when she was 3, she could sign into Netflix and pick her own show. And she knew exactly how to do that. I found that fascinating, you know.
Well, speaking of which now, we had something similar with music when Pro Tools came out. And now all of a sudden, everyone was a recording engineer. You didn't have to go to a recording studio. And then, of course, with digital distribution, now everybody became their own record label. So you didn't have to go stand before an A&R man or do a showcase in New York City. And it seems like the same thing now with the iPhone, as you say, which is really a camera with a phone in it. How has that affected the art of photography as you see it?
Well, I think it's expanded it. I mean, I always enjoy taking pictures and I see other people really enjoying taking pictures. They'll take a picture and immediately look at it. And in my time, there was that moment with the Polaroid. There's lots of pictures of people looking at Polaroid because once you took the Polaroid, you immediately looked at it to see what it was going to look like. And that's a moment that people, you know, universally shared, that moment of waiting for the picture to appear. And now you're not waiting for it to appear, but everybody wants to know immediately, what does it look like? And I see people smiling and enjoying it. And that's something I always did. So I think it's good that people can take pictures, people can show pictures of what's going on. I find that the quality is so amazing. The way the algorithm reads the light. Last June, part of the Tribeca Film Festival, there were two films that came out, one from Blondie and one from Kiss. Kiss has a documentary and Blondie had a documentary about their trip to Cuba. I got invited to both of the screenings, which were outdoors, and they played a short set, each band, after the... They were different days. And I took pictures of them. You look at my Instagram, that picture is as good as any picture I've taken with my bigger camera.
We're just listening to two tracks. The first was Kiss doing Nothing to Lose, and then One Way or Another by Blondie. So, we are done, but we are not done. What does that mean? Well, there is so much information and so much more music with this interview that we're putting this into two parts. So next week will be part two of the Bob Grun interview. I want to thank you all for listening. On behalf of co-host, head honcho for Know Your Bass Player and all-around nice guy, Tom Semioli, I want to say good night. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Take care.